What other things did you get through the contract? We talked to, sort of around some of the issues. There was wage increases and...
Holidays. Mm-hmm. Holidays, which we didn't have before. We had holiday.
You had no holidays before?
No. No, a holiday, and those who were, after so many years, get a holiday. Like, it started with 2%, 1% or 2%, like it did in the post office. We started with 2%, then 4, then 6, then 8. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it was. Then when we started, we could have holidays, but before we couldn't have any holidays at all. Right. Couldn't even have a week off. So the working conditions were the thing that I was more interested in, as well as increase in pay. Sometimes I thought that if we got a same take-home pay and got a 40-hour work week, that was a victory within itself in comparison.
What about food on the job?
Oh, they used to have us, we used to have a free, they used to let us eat. They didn't charge us until the labor act said that we have to pay. Well, the boss says, well, how come? Well, you see, we weren't allowed to eat. I was so we okay. That's another thing in the contract. I said, all right. I said, I'll tell you what I agree. And I said, I don't know who else is going to agree to it. But when we were just writing out the contract, they're changing, making changes. I said, how about? I'm willing to pay for my meal if that's the case. If I'm going to eat garbage, I'm going to pay for my meal. Let me be waited on. But then, of course, they said, "Well, you know, you're cutting your own throat. We want to work towards free dinners." But I said, "They're going to charge us, but they're going to restrict us to one meal a day. I don't know what it is now. But they gave us two meals a day." And we were told what we can eat and what we can't eat. We couldn't have bacon, we couldn't have ham, we couldn't have steaks. We could have stews, we couldn't have ice cream, we could have soup. So, you know, this is the situation. So then they started, there later on they were going to charge us. You see, that income tax came in. Mm-hmm. And that was a gratuity that you have to put down on tax. That's you're getting that gratis.
Right.
So you have to claim that in
so
the tax.
Taxed for it.
Same as tips. Yeah, same as tips. The lodgings, $350 a week, you have to pay toward that, goes towards your wages. And gratuity in tips. If you worked in a first-class house, and if you can't, they quote the percentage for you. If you don't remember, we'll quote it for you, the income tax. And how that came about is loudmouth people again. People that worked in hotels like the Devonshire and the Motel Vancouver, they'd be talking about how much tips they make. And it's overheard, the conversation's overheard by management, by staff, by customers. And one time there was several income tax men sitting at the counter. That was in the 40s. And they say, "You what?" And that's what brought that about, somebody having a big mouth.
Incredible.
Isn't it incredible? They just kept quiet and said no, they wouldn't. And then that's when they came out in the income tax, the gratuities. So if you worked in a second class or third class house, they didn't bother with you. But in the first class houses, they did.
By when did you have the 1,200 people in the local? Was that by the 40s? By
yes, the in the 40s, yes.
So when did the bulk of the organizing happen? All the way through the 30s and 40s?
Well, then after, I left the hotel trade. I worked in the West Coast Central Club, which was a private club in 54, and I had an accident. Then I didn't go back there to work. I went clerking at a hotel, and I was a clerk for 3 years, and that was a union hotel.
Right.
Yeah. But after that, I wasn't in. Oh yes, there were people from the hotel trade and different waiters that I knew were telling me to go into the cocktail lounges to work. That you're silly now that you could make real good money. And they used to often ask, and that, oh yeah, and Chris's Grill. That's another place we organized. I worked there. I was a shop steward. I worked there 3 years. And I left the Empire Cafe to go to Chris's Grill. And people and different employees that I knew would ask me to go and work at the Devonshire or go to Bay Shore Inn when it opened up. And they said, you're ridiculous working here for a song and dance. I said, no, I'm happier here because that's catering. That's too much catering. Like, I don't mind catering, but not too much. You know, I mean, between working, serving wealthy people and well-to-do, and I'd rather serve a working class any day.
Because of the way that you can.
The working class are behind you, and you know they're behind you all the way. If an incident happened in the restaurant with the boss and an employee, they were right there. The men were right there, or women, whoever, mostly men, would stick up for us. And they'd say, we'll never come in here again. You know, knock it off. This is the kind of establishment we had with rapport with the customers that knew us and knew what we were like and knew who we were. And the boss wouldn't dare get out of line. But you don't get that in the customer's always right in one of the upper class places. Doesn't matter if the customer's in the wrong, he's always right. When you go to these other places to work, that's why I never wanted to work in those places, because I couldn't be honest with myself. I helped organize them, but I would never work in them.
Did the kinds of struggles, like particularly the unemployed struggle of the 30s, did that really affect sort of working class women's consciousness about what was going on around them?
Oh yes, women were better organized then. The working class was organized better then than they are now, I think, in some instances. Because the housewives were organized. The housewives were all, especially with the union, with the IWA. And wherever their men were, they were there. They were behind their men all the way. And as soon as an incident would happen, they'd be in there, they'd be in the hall, and they'd be behind that table, and they're right in there helping right away. Nobody hesitated. Nobody hesitated. They couldn't. There's just a slender thread that they were going to smash a union or anything. Oh boy, they were right there. The women were right behind their men. You know,
How did that kind of consciousness develop? Was it because the women just saw the
the
relationship?
struggle, the struggle. Then they knew. Then the women, of course, they sent their boys overseas. You know, which was another heartache. And the men then began to feel, and then that's when the men and women were really united. Men and women were really united then.
During the war.
Oh yes, they really were. They were out to help each other, and they knew that their men had come. And I used to feel sorry for a lot of them. They never knew whether their men would come back, and they had to raise the kids by themselves. You know, it was tough. You know, really, it was hard for women. It really was.
Did women in the 30s talk about specifically, I guess, what I'd call women's issues, like birth control and childcare and maternity leave and that kind of stuff?
Maternity leave, that was brought into through the left wing people in the to bring it into the UIC Act. That, as a matter of fact, it was the NDP that tried to launch that even before it came due. They were in favor of getting that was thrashed out. That was a big struggle, getting that maternity leave and getting all those laid into the law. You know, and then notice they've been trying to throw it out several times.
Recently.
Yeah, oh yes. Yes, they're working on it to bring that, because they're finding out that they're almost afraid of going bankrupt half of the time, I guess. They think they're giving out so much money. But then they also must remember that those women are all coming back to work, and they're going to pay into the system again.
You can talk.
Well, into the UIC.
Right,
And likewise, income tax.
Okay. The retail stores, when the organizing was happening there, how did people reach people in retail stores? Did you leaflet and?
Oh yeah, you leaflet. You didn't talk to them on the floor. You didn't talk to them in the stores or anything. You waited and met them outside, just like we did in the restaurants.
So you would leaflet the restaurants, would you, when you were organizing?
Well, we didn't have money to have leaflets, so we figured that was money being put out of our own pockets, so why don't we just go and talk to them? You know, sometimes we'd write up a few things and Xerox some things, and then we'd tell them. But you see, sometimes I find the leaflets worked against us. You see, if the boss gets a hold of a leaflet, then he already knows that there's somebody planted in there. You see, that's why I say you had to move cautiously.
Because the information about the conditions would be in it.
Yes, yes, you see, and he doesn't want that known, you see. No, I mean, anybody, any of the bosses, I guess, didn't want that known to the public. You know, they would just... That's why I say that sometimes, in some incidents, you've got to know when and when not to.
Yeah.
You know. You, if you've got the majority already organized, then it's all right to put out these leaflets. You know, if you've got the bulk of the people in there already organized. But you know, the people become frightened. That's what you gotta. That's what we had to have be afraid of. Is people becoming frightened and threatened.
Was it harder to organize like a big place, like a retail outlet, like a Woolworths, than, you know, a small restaurant?
Oh yes, oh yes, yeah. It really was, because they were on their tail right away. Woodward's was another. He pays way over and above Union. That's why, because he never wanted the place organized. They'll never organize Woodward's. They'll never organize Woolworths. It's too far gone now.
Also, was turnover as big a problem then as it is now in those places?
In the Woolworths, I think once they were tickled to death to get a job and they stayed, it takes a long time to train you and you've got to know of every item they have in the store.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to learn. They give you an instruction sheet and you have to learn every. I know, because I try to organize this one girl over here, that two of them that worked over here at the, that's where they had the strike.
Mm-hmm.
On the one on Main Street, and she showed me what she had to learn. It's incredible, because she's got to know of every item in that store and the price of it. But they claim they train them, so the training is free. You see, this is another thing. This is another thing that they used to want, that they stipulated when we were negotiating. What about the training? Don't we ever get any credit for training you? After all, you come in green and we train you. We don't take anything for that. Don't we get compensated for that? You see? They used to hang that over our head. But, it doesn't matter what you try to do or how you try to do it. You came there with all sincerity. They'll try and trick you, or
yeah, right.
It's always that little thing there that you have to be careful of, had to watch, because they're not. They pretend, make a pretense of being your friend, you know. But then there were employers that were all for a union, because they found out that they had a union house. They had a good crew. Like I'd have problem when I was a shop steward. Occasionally, some girl would come in a little bit drunk. And it stipulates right in the contract that if you come in intoxicated, that you lose a day's wages. You know, or was it 2 days? I can't quite remember. And the second time, the first time is a warning, the second time you're fired.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was policing, naturally I was a shop steward, I was policing. Well, I had a terrible time with this worker. She was calling me a boss lover and everything, because I said, no. I said, just read this contract. I said, you've read it before? She said, I'm not, it doesn't say in there. I said, yes, it does. So I can't go against the contract. We helped to write this contract, and I agree to this, and I can't, you're in the wrong, and therefore
mm-hmm.
it says, stipulates right there that you lose a day's wages. When you work for nothing one day. So I said, well, that's the only way you could do that was to stipulate that in there, is because the girls used to come in pretty inebriated.
Mm-hmm.
And it's awful hard trying to work with somebody that's, you know, there's lots of times that we'd rush to their aid and give them black coffee and they'd cooperate and we'd try and get them on their feet and then give them ammonia or to sniff or something to help them out, you know. We stuck together, but then there's always a little one in there that's a little difficult to handle, you know. Those are the ones that used to give us a bad time.
Was there a real feeling of sort of solidarity?
Oh, yes. Yes. Always. That was always. If women became catty, you know, in a place, and I'd say, well, he who is without sin cast thy first stone. Do you know anybody that's perfect? You know, because they'd go on, and I mean, it's no good running your own sex down, because we all have our faults.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, same with men. I'm more for the people's liberation. I'm more for that. I think that we should stick together as much as possible, the men and women. I really do, and I think that the men should be liberated, just like women. I think men have been brought up to have short pants and be afraid to cry sort of thing, and afraid to come show his feelings. Whereas men are starting to break down now, they've wanted to do this all along, but they were too afraid, you know. And so they need to be liberated, because they've had to play a role that was just as stuffy as the role we played. I mean, we had to play the role that we're going to be a mother someday, so you better be decent when your guy comes along.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't want to be a runaround and get a reputation. In those days, you had to be careful about a reputation. In those days, once the gossip got around, gossip can kill you, and it could be all lies, but it can ruin your life.
Okay. What do you remember? Any specific kinds of grievances or incidents that came up when you were a steward that were particularly sort of maybe typified what women faced in, you know, working for the restaurant?
Well, they faced was hard work,
yeah.
Lots of hard work. And the harder worker you are, the better the boss looked up to you, and the more he thought of you. Whereas, if the men were a little bit on the lazy side or something, they'd seem to lean towards the men. Well, the women will do it. The women will do it, don't do it. Because we were so much more conscientious in so many ways.
Is that because you were really sort of afraid to lose your jobs?
No, because we are conscientious. Because women can work rings around men, honestly. Because you have to, when you're a working mother, you're thinking of four things to do before you go to work, or 10 things. You're rushing to do this, do your shopping, you're rushing to do this, rushing to do that. You're thinking ahead, and therefore when you go to work, you're fast. You've got that speed that you work with.
Mm-hmm.
And the bosses will tell you, even in the post office, the majority of the superintendent, supervisor will tell you that when it comes to getting the mail done, let's get the women. And our superintendent, the big superintendent that retired that helped us build our union too, by the way, he always used to ask for all women in the Christmas help and the primary. He said, I want all women, period, because they're better workers. They're more conscientious. They get the work done. And they get the work done, men are still. We see men take their time. See, they haven't got this household thing over their heads. Whereas a woman's, the philosophy and the psychology with women is different from men. You see, that's where we differ. And it's time we understood one another. You know, but the men are beginning to understand women now, in that they say, well, a woman can work rings around me. You see, they're beginning to own up to these things, which is true.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. When Woolworths was being organized, you mentioned that there was a strike. Was that because you signed up enough people?
Yes, we signed up enough people. Yes, we did.
What's sort of the story of that strike? What happened?
Well, I kind of phases me a little bit now, but I know that when we had the bulk of them, we organized. They were all organized, and they said that they willingly joined the union. They weren't harassed or forced, and they willingly joined the union, and that they wanted better wages. And I went to picket also on that, but you see, we weren't. They were too afraid to let too many outsiders come in and picket. They're starting this business now, much more now than they used to. If you have no business there, you have no right picketing. Mm-hmm. You see, at one time we had where no matter where you were from, or what union you were with, you came to picket on a voluntary basis. Well, there's not so much of this now. But when we went over to picket over here, the customers would go by and they'd say, well, what's the good of picketing this place when all the other Woolworth stores, there's no picketers there, you see? And this is what I always told them, concentrate and organize all the 5 and 10s in the greater Vancouver. Then it's going to be tough, but this way you lose out. Mm-hmm. And they did. They lost out.
So they lost the strike?
They lost it. Yeah, they lost that strike. Sure. Right. Because there's not enough backing. Yeah. You see, the other employees were going to work. I mean, this is a ridiculous situation. I mean, you've got to organize. And if you're going to have a chain, you've got to organize. Well, that's what they're doing with the Sandman Inn. The only one that isn't organized now is the one on Georgia Street. That's the only one that isn't organized. The other ones, of course, they have that intimidation kind of organizing, you join the union or else sort of thing, you know, that strong arm kind of type of organizing. That's how the SIU organized. You come and come in and join our union or we'll blow your boat up, that sort of thing. This is goon squatting, and that's that type of strong mafia type organizing.
After the retail campaign, what campaigns did you then work on after that?
Well, I didn't work. I still more or less stayed in within the into Local 28, right. and concentrated all as much on the restaurants as much as possible. Yeah.
So you were on the executive board and you were a steward, during that period of time, when was it sort of that you went through that kind of jump in numbers when you really built up? Was that in the Lower Mainland that you did that?
Yes, in the Lower Mainland, yeah. I think that was from it was from the early 40s to the late 40s that I would say, well, there was several times we brought the membership. The membership was brought up, and then it collapsed. They went down because we were fought, like I say,
yeah.
The bartenders were fighting us. They didn't want us to grow because you can see why. They were always afraid we'd get over them, you see. But, of course, all the bartenders were all waiters, you see, because they all worked in taverns and,
sure.
You know. But they didn't want us to get ahead. You know, you could just sense it. You knew it all along.
Did the war help you to organize? The fact that there was now labor legislation that had come in that permitted organizing?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. There was, yes. Well, then you got your Hard Rock Miners. I guess you've heard of, what's his name, that organized in Alberta, Harvey Murphy.
Sure.
Well, even after that, I mean, they started the construction workers, the building trades.
Mm-hmm.
They all started coming up, and it was easier to organize then.
Was that because did women also come into the hotel and restaurant industry who had been experienced in war industries? And maybe
yes. Some of them were taken off their jobs. Of course, we were all frozen to our jobs, but the waitresses weren't frozen because we could leave that. That wasn't considered essential.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a friend, just quite a few friends that worked in shipyards, and they worked hard. They claimed that the women were better than men, better workers.
Mm-hmm.
in the shipyards.
Did any of those women after the war maybe come back into the restaurant?
Not any, some might have, but not very many. I think they went into other areas. Once you get out of the restaurant, just like when I got out of the restaurants and went into the clerking and hotel, I never went back.
Right.
I never, I mean, sometimes I like to go back, but I don't know whether I would, you know, of course, people the way they are today, they're snarly, mean, and nasty sometimes. So, you know, you just often wonder, you have a hot bowl of soup in your hand, you know, you might... They might wear it, you know, because you lose your patience with, you know, you can become, you know, because, I used to take insults out of this world. I don't know how I tolerated it, but we all did. You know, we were considered bad girls because we were waitresses, you know.
Oh, really?
We had to defend our reputation. Oh, yes. Easy come, easy go. They're just if you want a waitress for the night, if you want a woman for the night, just go and ask a waitress out. That's the reputation we had. And then after they left us alone, and they started on the stewardesses. Then they started on the nurses. You know, it was always women. No, it was never men. It was always, it was never doctors. You never heard about doctors, interns, or anything like that. But then the Hollywood movies kind of evened that out for us.
When did you become a desk clerk? Was that in...
That was in the 50s. That was after my daughter was born. It was before she was born. I worked right up on 9 days before I had my daughter.
Were you waitressing then? Or?
No, clerking. Oh. That reminds me of when we had our strike, 68 strike in the post office. The Women's Auxiliary from the Allied Fishermen's Workers held a dance for us, and the tickets were $3, but they were supplying the hall, they were supplying the food. All we had to do was sell the tickets to our membership to support the dance.
Right.
And I was just absolutely fractured when I found out amongst some of the, well, you see, there you are. They weren't true trade unionists, because if they were, you wouldn't have to ask them to go and support their own dance. They would have done that anyway. But when I approached them to sell them tickets, $3? I can't afford $3, because after all, we just got on off a strike. I mean, how do you expect us? Where are we going to get $3 from?
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, never mind. I just thought maybe you'd be interested to support your own cause.
Right.
Because I said, these people are going out of their way, completely, totally out of their way. And they had the most grandest food, and I was so embarrassed. And Jim McCall says to me, Marion, please don't feel that bad, because I feel bad too. There was only 7 of us there.
At this dance,
supporting this dance for the W workers. 7 of us. Isn't that heartbreaking?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you see, at one time, if they ever held a dance for a strikers, oh, that hall would have been packed. Every member would have been there. That kind of solidarity that you don't get now.
So there was a real spirit of militancy amongst women in the 30s.
Then. Oh, yes, definitely. Right. Yes, yeah, that you don't. That's why we find it very difficult to be in the... That's why it's so hard for me to... Because I can't go on apologizing, but then you got to consider human nature is human nature. You know, times have changed, but I still would like to see this solidarity and this love come back
mm-hmm.
among the organized... And among the trade unions.
Right. You mentioned that in 48 there was, or 47, 48, there was a big sort of turnover in the union. Can you talk a little bit about what happened then when the International intervened?
In 48 is when I went to the convention. In 48, I think it's in 49. I think it was when the turnover when they imposed the trusteeship. And then I guess I imagine May told you about that, did she? Well, that was when. Well, of course, and then what you had with the, what you had there was the right wing people took over. You see, and it was run like a Gestapo union after that. I mean, it wasn't the militancy that we had. Like they'd say, well, what do you? They said to me, what are you carrying the Tribune paper for in here? You know, that sort of thing. Why are you carrying these left-wing papers in here? Why are you doing that? You see what I mean? You see how suspicious they were. And she just thought that was a natural course of things. I mean, you read what you want to read. This is a democratic state. And you read whatever you want to read. It's published and you read it. You buy it or whatever. But then after that, I was still in there. There was several business agents that I didn't particularly care for. They were from the local 676, mm-hmm. most of them. See, they asked me, prior to that, to run. May has asked me to run, and Emily Watts, but I would never run because I'm too hot-headed. You know, because I'm better at working in the background than I am
doing
out front.
Doing some rank and follow.
Yeah, that I'm better in that because I get all wound up, and you know, and I'm better off just being not on, because if I was a business agent, I'd probably, you know, just be marching every day, you know. Because I'd have to take care. I'd have to just be there everywhere, and I'd have to see that they're not trying to bust our union. You see, in every shape and form, and it would just take too much out of me, because I'm too conscientious.
You were saying earlier that women, when you were young, women used to be part of the labor movement and speak publicly and play a really important role. Can you talk a bit about what you were just saying earlier?
Yes, there was many of them that would be in the movement, and they would get up from that, and they'd talk, and they weren't afraid of anybody. They fought for their families and they fought for the rights of women, and they weren't afraid of anybody, and they were such courageous people, and they could talk rings around anybody. They could just the words would just flow, and they were respected and admired by even opposition, like Effie Jones, for instance. She was admired and respected by her people that were dead against her, you know. And there's some women like that, women that never backed away from anything like that. And I think that's a beautiful trait that women have, that they're not afraid.
Where did that come from? Was it in part through the early feminist movement? And
I think that came from. From the time the mid-Victoria, I think that came. I think Victoria had something to do with that. I think she was a woman that came out, and she defied men. I mean, it was out in during her reign. I mean, she used to tell the men that to be careful how you handle a situation, that it can backfire on you. And she told them about the Indian movement, the Indians, the natives in Canada. To be careful how you handle that, because later on it'll work against you. And she was right, but just because she was a woman, they just wouldn't listen to her. I mean, it was men that were ruling them mostly in that around that era about the Indians. But I mean, if they had listened to her, I think the situation would have been totally different today.
You were describing a meeting that you attended where Murphy was there from Mine Mill. What was that?
Yes, that was a meeting. That was a meeting that we had when we were fighting for. This was a one meeting that Murphy was there was a miner strike, And then there was another meeting when we had this big meeting for the Red Dean. They called him the Red Dean, Dr. Hewitt Johnson, is it? From Canterbury. And they had a meeting there, and I was one of the fortunate people to be able to shake hands with Dr. Johnson, Hewitt Johnson, and he's a beautiful human being, a beautiful, beautiful human being. And he's had long hair, silvery gray, down his back of his neck. And then he had this cloak on, this black cloak, and it looked like he just stepped from Dickens' novel, you know. And he was so concerned. He was really concerned. He was worried. He was really worried. And when he said in his meeting, one thing that he stressed about, that he said when he went to the east, to visit the countries in the east, he says, you know, as myself being a Christian, I could overlook their godlessness when they were overtaken to repair their countries after the terrible war. He said, and how they're working, and how they're working together. And he said, and they're not even religious. They're not even Christians, and most of them. He said, don't even follow the Bible. And he said, that overwhelmed him. That he just couldn't get over that. He overlooked their godlessness, you know, for the wonderful work that they were doing for their people. Mm-hmm. And then he said that would have discouraged most of the Western states to no end. But they said, well, we just have to start building again. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and the hope was there. I think that's what it was. It's hope, brotherly love and hope.
How about Bethune?